My name is Irene Kurka and I welcome you to my podcast, Neue Musik Leben. I have studied classical singing and voice, but I love to sing contemporary and experimental music. If you would like to know more about me, please look at my website www.irenekurka.de. In this podcast, I talk with you about topics all around contemporary music. I share with you behind the scenes insider knowledge, and I want to bring closer to you the human beings out of the new music world. Thank you very much for all your emails and feedbacks. I'm cooperating with the NMZ, Neue Musik Zeitung. In this episode, my guest is Catherine Konz. She's a composer who is from Luxembourg, but nowadays lives in London. So enjoy my conversation with Catherine Konz. Hello, Catherine. Catherine Konz, I welcome you today into my podcast.
Hello. Hello. Good morning.
It's great to see you. I can see you. The people now can only hear you. And I would like to know from you, how did you find your way into new and experimental music?
Yes. It took a while, actually. I'm not one of those who grew up with it and knew what to do from very early on. Music was always, I should say piano playing was always a part of what I did, but it was always my hobby and it was never, you know, I did the whole conservatoire, but it was never meant with the aim of doing that as a profession at all. That was not on my radar. So it took quite a while, and I first went to study economics even. I did a little detour. It's very important to find what you don't want to do in life. So I found
that's also very, very important. Yes,
exactly. So that, I did that first, and then I had a change of heart, and I left Paris for London, and I thought I would give music a try because I had all the, you know, I was equipped for it in some way because I had finished the conservatoire, I had the first prize and all that, but it was just, you know, being a classical pianist is a certain a kind of life and a certain kind of thing. And I was already 21 and I had not won all these competitions and these things. So I didn't really think I could do that. But then I realized I could maybe do something else in music, be a musicologist, or I didn't even think of composition then yet. And I was still very much in the old music. And so I arrived at Goldsmith, the only university who would have me because I applied so late. It was all chaotic because I left in the middle of the year. I arrived there and it was just wonderful. It was such an experimental place. And because it's a university of arts and humanities, it's just a very creative, open space. And you're never the strangest person around. And I found that so liberating because in Paris, I always stuck out a bit like a, I don't know how you say that. You know, they called me the Le Canary because I had a yellow jacket and everyone was dressed in French, in black, yeah, like the French. exactly. So in London, I didn't feel like that. I felt like I could just be myself and I had a place. And so I could just explore. And then in the first year, we had to all take composition. And I was surprised. I thought, oh, am I allowed? Because I had done all the harmony and all the, all the theory. But I had not really been encouraged to write my own. And I wasn't so aware of music being written right now anyway, except pop and all other things. But contemporary classical was not really on my radar. And so the first year at Goldsmith, it was just one door after the other just opened its own world. I had my piano teacher was John Tilbury, which was just amazing. Again, it was just so lucky. And so he introduced me to Cage and Feldman, and I played all the repertoire. He specialized in Skempton and all these British composers, Cardew. And it was just wonderful. Yeah, so I became very excited. And then I had composition with Roger Redgate, who also introduced me to all these new notations, new musics, experimental, like extended techniques, all things I had not come across before. So it was very inspiring. And I felt like I found my thing as well then, because composition somehow, it brought all the things together that I like. It's like putting a puzzle together, but with, you know, thinking creatively, what, how can you make it? And then, because Goldsmith was not at all conservative or putting you in a box or telling you what to compose or how to compose, and there were a lot of artists around and performance art was quite of the moment anyway, I very quickly saw everything very visually, or maybe it's just how I think about music. And so I immediately went in for the weird stuff, let's say. and I always had some graphics on my scores or something that I would make theatrical about the performance, because any performance, I thought, is a theater anyway. As soon as you come on stage with an instrument or without, as soon as there is a musician on stage, it is a theater show. So you might as well incorporate other elements into your piece if they fit. So so it was just lovely. And then, so I liked it so much, I then studied for a long, long time. They didn't get rid of me.
But it sounds ages. Really like your thing, that once you found it, it was obviously so easy for you. And I mean, doesn't sound like a big struggle, but really like this almost like childish excitement and fun. And I just do it and everything comes together. I mean, this is
and I
fantastic
still feel like
that.
That I think I don't think I have lost that. It is still the same for me. I just feel so lucky all the time that I'm allowed to do this. I'm a little surprised still.
That's really amazing that it found you on this way.
Yeah.
And then I mean, obviously Goldsmith opened many doors for you, but then you also studied in Luxembourg. And you lived there?
Yes, so
how
the conservatory
was that? I mean, that's a quite a different country, I think.
I know. And so my whole education as a child and teenager was very classical, conservatoire, mainly piano, but then also some chamber music or, all the theater, solfège, 7 years of solfège, 7 clefs, singing, sight reading, dictations, you know, very kind of the French way, I guess, or Belgian, which gives you a very good basis, but it's very inhibitive creatively. You know, it's really, I was taught that this is the score, play it exactly as it is there in front of you, you know, don't add your personality either, just play it very precisely, which is fine, but it just, I didn't improvise either. It was just not on my radar like that. So that was another thing I discovered that.
So you were in Luxembourg before you went to Goldsmith? Or?
Well, I am Luxembourgish, so I am.
Okay.
I grew up there. Yeah, so I'm from there.
Okay.
So from the age of six, so I studied the piano at six with a wonderful teacher, Madame Ries, without whom I think I would not have become a musician, because at some point I would have probably lost my, enthusiasm for practicing, and I would have rather gone ice skating with my friends or something, you know, at the age of 12, 13. But she was so, her enthusiasm for music was so contagious, and the lessons were so wonderful. We had such a good time, and I had her until I was 18. I never changed it. They sometimes tried to get me to a different teacher in the conservatory. There was a director who had ideas somehow. Don't want to go into that anyway. And then sometimes I would have one or two, and I usually made it quite clear that I would actually rather be with my teacher, my other teacher. And can I just go back? So, and then I just went back, and so I was not really interested in having anyone else. It was, you know, it was just, I liked having her lessons, and that was enough for me. That was fine. I was not
set out to become her. But you also got a good basis, right? If you did the solfège.
Yeah, I mean, she was a very...
Your musicianship was very trained.
Yes, it was. And that was brilliant, because I could then really fall back on that. I would not have gotten into Goldsmith. I had to kind of start practicing again when I then applied, because, you know, when I studied economics, I played for fun a little bit. But if you don't have an aim or concerts or so, then you lose it a little bit. You don't practice in the same way. So, I had to get myself
And the new music has now grown more in Luxembourg, right? I mean, you have Philharmonie, and you have the Rainy Days, the big festival.
Exactly, yeah, which is wonderful. And all that didn't exist when I lived there. So I left in 95, really. That's when I went to Paris. And then in 98, I came to London. And at that time... there was very little, you know, there was one concert a week or so by the orchestra at the theater. And if you didn't have reserved cards already, you couldn't go, really. So sometimes my piano teacher took me, which was lovely. But I had seen and heard very little live music, really, if I compare to what my children now already have seen and heard. It's a completely different ballgame. But I think the world has changed a bit, and there's just more on offer. Children are exposed to different things now. But yes, the Philharmonie is a wonderful establishment, and the Rainy Days Festival, I've written many pieces for it. And I had an extra fun one this year, which it was Lydia Rilling's idea who was doing the festival now, so we did a live sound walk. So sometimes I really enjoy taking music out of the concert hall and into other places to make it more accessible in some way without compromising the music, but to get it to people who would not maybe come to the Philharmonie, but they might come to the outside of the, you know, where this was by kind of bridges and by the river, and it was a kind of whole little walk along the Alsace, which is the river that runs past the Luxembourg old walls. And so it was created for the UGDA, it's called, and it's the association of all the music schools in Luxembourg. So there were about 140 children participating, and with their teachers, and that was lovely as well, because there is this you know, there's a special thing with music, with passing on your knowledge one to one to a person, and you have very good connections like that. I mean, I'm very fond of all my teachers, and I don't think there are many musicians who would have become musicians without having at least one very inspiring teacher in their life at some point. Mm-hmm. Or choir master, or someone who believed in them, and then who passed on that knowledge, or passed on that enthusiasm for music. And so so it was lovely to see these groups of trumpeters with their teacher then tackling this work. That so it was in seven stations, we called it. So it's kind of seven mini concerts on the way. So the audience walks together, mm-hmm. and as they approach another station, the music starts again. And it was called Driva Drena Drop, which means also drüber, drunter, drauf in German. Mm-hmm. So above, below, and kind of on top. And it refers to the bridges that are around that, mm-hmm. Well, in Luxembourg anyway, and around that town. And so sometimes the music came from above and sometimes from the other side of the river. Sometimes the audience were below, but you know, it's kind of,
I can really imagine, because I actually have been to Luxembourg City.
Oh, lovely, lovely.
Built, yes. And I can really, yeah, see it. And I have been into those caves and everywhere.
Yes,
and
exactly.
So we have this bridge and this part, and I think, yeah, it's perfect. So are the people then open for contemporary music? Do they go to those concerts and performances in Luxembourg?
I think so. I mean, it's, you know, not everyone, of course. it's probably the same group of people who are always coming out for contemporary music anyway. But then often when I do a piece like this, which is then relatively accessible and in a fun place, and it's free to come to, and the children can come too, and they can come as a family, let's say, I also have my friends come out, or people who never otherwise go to contemporary music. I have a group of four or five really old friends in Luxembourg who don't really know anything about contemporary music, but they only come to my pieces, I think, which is lovely. And then sometimes they don't like it at all, I think. And sometimes they find it interesting, and often they enjoy it.
That's the other thing.
We had to listen to this, and that was quite boring. So we had a bit of champagne in the break, and then there was your piece. That was great.
Because I'm often thinking about this thing, how we get new music out of our new music bubble, because I think, yeah, we're doing such great music, and there are different aesthetics and styles, and there's so much fun in it. And I always wonder how we can get it more across, because I want to get out. I don't want to,
yes,
sit in my,
yeah,
bubble, even though the bubble is nice and I like my colleagues and everything. But how do we get it out of the bubble?
I think education is a big part, and there it has changed now a little bit in Luxembourg also, that at the time, as I said already, I grew up very classical. So music kind of stopped in 1950. I wasn't really aware of anything else. I had played maybe one recent piece, but that was it really. Whereas now there were, you know, all these children who and youngsters who participated in this project, for example, they will be aware now that there are composers like me who are working in it now, and their teachers were open to practice it with them and teach them. So there were some funny techniques in it as well. There were some bits where the trombones had to do noises like traffic noises. I thought that would be fun for once. They could really do all the motor revving and things, because it was nature against the city. And so, mm-hmm, the horns were playing nature sounds and the trombones were playing city sounds. And so you get to experiment a bit with your instrument. And I think that's so important. So I think it's the education, introducing it early, so that they don't, even if they don't become musicians later in life, they will have a notion of that there is this new music, and they don't need to be afraid of it because they have done it already. It's not anything, you know, scary or strange or you know, because this was also organized by the Philharmonie, although it was not in the building, they will hopefully also not have any inhibition with even like looking at the program of the Philharmonie or going into that building, because that I think that's what opera houses, for example, find, that because it is the opera and the house, and it's somehow in people's mind, it has all these connotations with the upper class, or that you have to know certain things to even go there, or be someone special to be there, or whatever. They don't even reach out to the people they would actually want there, or some people don't think that they don't dare to even go in the line to buy a ticket. Even if the tickets are £5 and usually they spend 200 on the football tickets, it's a strange thing like that. So introducing it early in schools, in any schools, and making young musicians aware that they can themselves compose, they can themselves improvise. It will also change their relationship to their instrument. It did for me, definitely, when it was also at Goldsmith. There was a concert suddenly in the first week, I think a lunchtime concert, and they were the performers said, it was people I had just met actually, but they all became friends later. We'll just do a page from Treatise. And I thought, oh, but what is that? A page from Treatise. And so I looked at it all, and so it's the graphic score by Cardew, and that was like the Bible at Goldsmith. I think whenever you wanted to just perform something and get together with people on stage, you would choose a few pages of that and then prepare it as much or as little as you want. It's either you react to it in the moment, or you actually have a think about these lines and spaces and circles and whatever.
I mean, it can be very freeing, Cardew.
Yes, exactly.
Really get into the fun of it and out so of your head, I think.
And it's a great way into then the free improvisation and just playing without having practiced a specific piece beforehand. It's so liberating. It's so lovely to realize you can do that, actually, because a lot of musicians are highly, highly trained. They never do that, actually. They never just play. Which is such a shame, and it should really be part of any training to at least be exposed to that. Mm-hmm. Yes. It's so weird how we build up all these barriers for ourselves while learning something. I don't know, it should be much freer. And so when I teach also little ones, when I teach the piano, then I always make sure they at least try composing, and some then really take to it, and others don't really seem to have an interest in it. And then you can leave it or encourage them more.
That's cool that you introduce it. Yeah. You just talked about like the young or other performers. What are the qualities you most appreciate in performers you work with?
Oh, in performers, I think it's lovely when they are up for anything. So if they are not afraid to try something new, because maybe I will put them out of their comfort zone in some way, because I often think in the room or with movement or a costume or something, I try not to make, I don't make them sing upside down or do anything too horrible, but it is often something that they have not done before maybe, and it's just lovely to then collaborate and see what is possible. I like that, just an openness to experiment, I think. That's what I appreciate the most.
And I know that you have written quite some pieces for voice, which I'm very happy about. And so how is it for you writing for The Voice? Because for some composers, it's very challenging. And I listened to some of your music and you even also, I must say, allow real singing. It's not just, you know, whatever, some weird extended techniques, but there also is some real singing. And I'm like, oh, how cool is that?
Exactly. I have a thing with The Voice. So as a child and teenager, I didn't listen to anything with voice because I couldn't stand it almost. I have a little bit of misophonia, so I'm sensitive to sounds like chewing and someone eating crisps or so. And if I'm too tired, I have to get up and leave. It really bothers me, and it is, I think it's a condition called misophonia, I found out now. I don't have it too much, but I think it had to do with the voice when I was little as well. So I was a weird child who would go and turn off stereos when there was, you know, something fun like Madonna or something on the radio.
Okay.
Not that. And I
only listened to, but now you're composing for The Voice.
Yeah, it then changed. Yeah, so so it then changed when I was maybe 16 or so. I discovered grunge and all those hoarse voices, which I really liked by then. And so the whole thing with The Voice was fine by then. I'm still sensitive to some tenor voices I just don't like. And it's just a personal thing. It's me, it's not them, basically. But
certainly,
it has brought me, it has brought me to maybe write a bit different for The Voice than other people. And so I was quite early on, I was asked to write for The Voice a few times. And then because they liked what I did, I kept getting asked for voice, and oh, do you want to do an opera? And it's like, I don't know, do I want to write opera? And then I somehow got into that, and I'm not even an opera person. I love the theater of it, but there is a reason why my PhD huge piece was a mime opera. There was no singing. It was everything else, but no voice. And with voice, you also always have text. And I always found that if you then put text into that, the text somehow takes precedence over other meaning of actions or visuals or other music. And that disturbed me as well. So I had to kind of think about that too. But somehow over the years, I really got drawn into it, and I've written a lot for voice somehow, and some proper operas, I would say.
Yes, yes, yes.
One of which Juliet sang also, and it was just that was a wonderful experience.
I also found that you've produced a project that lasted 12 hours. That's really long.
Oh, yes. So that is another. So there I am. Yes. Yeah. 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 It's not for the faint-hearted. I work with Rosie Middleton. She's a mezzo-soprano who is up for anything. And I do appreciate that. And so she initially asked me to write a piece for her voiceless project, where she commissioned quite a few composers to write something that had to do with trauma for voice, which could be, an emotional trauma where you are not allowed to speak or you can't speak or you're anything like that. Or it could be actual physical trauma where you don't have a voice anymore or anything like that. So a lot of composers chose the emotional traumas of some sort. And then she asked me if I had an idea already. And I said, no, actually, I haven't really thought about it. And then she said, oh, no one is doing endurance yet. And I was interested in that. And would you consider that? And I thought, oh, yeah, endurance. That's very interesting, because I always love for me, composing is all about the mind and how you think. And I'm always trying to find new ways of making myself, you know, look at things in a different way, or think in a different way, or how can I see it in a new way. That for me is always exciting. And so I am inspired by many, many different things usually that I read about and then try and incorporate into my thinking. But in this case, I read a lot about how marathon and ultra marathon runners think, and even had a conversation with one ultra marathon runner for whom one marathon is like nothing. So they just continue running, and it's the psychology of it is so fascinating. And because singers are like athletes, really, I see them like that, really, because the voice, the instrument is so physical. So you have to live like an athlete, basically, to make your instrument your.
Yeah. I totally agree, because you know, I watch how much and how I sleep, what I eat.
Yes,
and for
exactly.
me it's even like during the Christmas days, there were 5 days I was not singing. And after that it's almost painful to get back into singing.
Oh wow.
And usually I don't make such breaks because I know that already. And then it takes me really 3 or 4 days to get back to my normal condition. And I always say singers are like,
oh, wow.
like sports, like profi sports or
yeah,
whatever
and
people.
It is, yeah. I think it's, other musicians also think about sleep probably and you know, if they feel well, they can perform better. And their hands are mm-hmm. often very looked after and so. But I have a sense that it's on a different level for singers. And so I thought it would be interesting to actually probe this a bit, because I like experimenting. So a lot of people say they do experimental music, but they don't really, they always know what comes out already. Mm-hmm. And really, if you do experimental music, you should not know what comes out. And that is such an exciting journey. So Rosie wanted this piece for her program, but then with endurance, you know, I guess you could write a piece that is 10 minutes and so exhausting that after that you are... finished.
I have done those pieces too.
Exactly. But somehow I was not so interested in that. I was really interested in the long run, you know, in doing something long and what you can do with it also in terms of storytelling, or how you stage it, how you are in the room, and how it can become an immersive experience for everyone, for the audience and for the performer. I love these, I'm very influenced, I think, and inspired by some theatre. So there's Robert Lepage, the Canadian director.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he's amazing, yes.
Yeah, and I've seen quite a few of his long performances. So you spend 5 hours in the theater or 7 hours in the theater. And it's just amazing because the whole, the show is not boiled down to the usual 60 minutes or what it needs to be, but there is time to actually be in it. So you have time to contemplate sometimes. You feel almost like you are living the story in real life, in real time. Of course, you're not still, because it's only 5 hours still, and maybe there are generations told of the, you know, the storyline. But it's just a very different way of living a piece or experiencing it. And so I don't know. I love that sort of thing. So I thought that this would be maybe the time to try that with music. And at the same time, I was working with at King's College. They have this, they have kind of developed a nice new spatial sound system, which it kind of goes, you know, it's speakers all around, and then it really gives you a feeling of the space you are in. So even if you're in a small room, it can feel like you're suddenly in a cathedral, or it can feel it's just that your oral space just opens mm-hmm. and closes. And there are a few systems that do that sort of things. And binaural does it on headphones. And I have worked with that before for sound walks, but this was kind of perfect for in the room. And so they let me use their system, and we did a residency at the King's College and at Somerset House to try this piece out. And so far we have only done 4 hours, because that was two weeks before lockdown this happened.
Okay.
And then so what happens is that the whole music here is composed with samples, let's say, or recordings more of every note of the scale that Rosie can mm-hmm. sing, a normal chromatic scale, and not microtone. I guess you could mm-hmm. come to infinity otherwise, but it's this is just a kind of chromatic. There's 2 octaves, I think we did, and we did it in many different ways, different dynamics, different colors, hums, or really super vibrato, no vibrato, all sorts of different ways. And and we had a residency also to see where we just experimented for a couple of days to see how long, what the difference is with the, you know, if you do the loudest, highest notes and the longest, lowest, and things like that. So, it varies between 4 seconds and 53 seconds or something, the duration of one breath, one note. And so the whole piece, the 12 hours, are composed with the material then that we recorded in all these different ways of hers. So I have the bank of Rosie, but another singer could just record their own bank mm-hmm. and then make the pieces are made so that an engineer could just put all these mm-hmm. different samples in the same places, and then it would sound like that again. And then she sings on top of that live. So every hour is different, but also has similarities, and there's always a journey through each hour in the room, in the space, in the performance space of what Rosie does. Mm-hmm. But with the idea that 12 hours, you know, is a long time. So if it's not possible to sing anymore, then it's okay to take half an hour out, and then you don't sing anything.
It's very interesting for me too, because I've sang a few years ago a piece by Antoine Boyga, which lasted 4 hours, and I did it at Huddersfield, yes. And also our friend James Weeks was involved in that. And the thing is, you cannot really rehearse 4 hours. I mean, we just rehearsed whatever 30 minutes, and the rest was then, like you said, you have to jump into the situation and see what happens. And for me, the fun thing was, or the interesting thing was, I was not really worried about being on stage 4 hours or singing quite a bit. And I mean, also, if you compare it to even a Wagner opera, you never as long on stage like that. I mean, even if you sing 40 minutes of Kundry or something, but that's not 4 hours. But the thing that concerned me the most was if I had to go to the bathroom.
Yes.
And then I talked about it with Antoine, and I knew where the bathroom was. And he says, if you really cannot do it, then go, come back and continue within the piece. But then it was fascinating because I think after it was with a stopwatch, so I knew the timing. And I think after like 2.5 hours, I then like, I think I should go. But then I forgot it. And then suddenly those 4 hours were over. I was so proud that, I mean, nobody used the bathroom, that I sang, I was present, but I also didn't go to the bathroom.
We are human. I mean, in the 12-hour piece, it's fine for Rosie to go out even of the room and come back, because that will be interesting, I think, for the audience actually to suddenly be left without. There will be this like an ellipse or like a void, or they will feel the lack of her, which is really interesting, I think. And because there is anyway sound, the piece continues all the time, if she's singing live on top or not. And she can put her material on top a bit where she wants. So that's all very, very free. And in that sense, it's feasible, I think. But still, Rosie was quite scared also before the 4 hours. I mean, we all didn't know what would happen, really. And I'm on the computer for the whole time, changing the sound.
So you're also very focused.
And for next time, for the 12 hours, I have to find a different position for the mouse. Actually, I have to sort that out, because I could see that actually I'm not used to that. I need to find another way. But because I can change the sound live in the room, I'm all the time sending her voice to this speaker or that speaker, or making the room smaller or doing something. So it is moving all the time. So I'm also there.
But it was also so intense, and I really, in a way, I was so happy that I did it, because it was such a big thing, and I really felt changed afterwards, after those 4 hours being with those colleagues on stage. And so I would go for it again, even though it is a challenge.
Exactly. I think these sort of events you don't forget, and you don't forget, they really mark you. And it is, you were probably changed because you lived through it, and you actually have time to think about it while you're doing it somehow. I don't know, it does change your outlook a bit than when you finish. I think 4 hours is fine, but Rosie was also equally concerned about the what if I have to go 3 times the first hour? Said, it doesn't matter, then you just go, you know. And she didn't need at all, she didn't leave at all. It just passed. And then at the end of the 4 hours, and that we had not anticipated it either, because we started on the clock, because that was easier to time everything. I had not realized that in that courtyard that the windows went to of the performance hall that we were in, there was a church. And so just when we finished, there were the church bells ringing, and it was just really magical. And a similar thing happened when we did Rivadrena Drop. We just finished, and then at the very end, the church bells also went with it, and it was just wonderful.
Cool, participating.
And it's these things. It just makes you so happy when you can't plan it. If you plan it, it will probably go wrong, you know. And but then when it happens, it's just so lovely.
And I know that you're now also a professor at the Royal College. Teaching and passing on your knowledge and experience and excitement.
It's really lovely. I mean, I've been teaching for a long time, but I was never attached to a particular institution. So I've been in and out of many universities and things, but only for, you know, workshops here and things there, and or private students. I've always had, but this is lovely. It's weekly lessons, so I really follow the students in what they do, and I think it's mutually inspiring. I hope. For me, definitely, I always get a bit excited about their ideas, and then I try and help them along. But you know, they all have their individual style. But that's so lovely about composition and composers. There are as many styles and ways of doing it as there are people. Almost, you know, mm-hmm. there's not one way, and. It's almost a way of just, seeing what is important around for you and then working through that in your music somehow. And for some people, it's very, some composers write very abstract, and some write quite, you really know what the piece is about, you know, or quite personal, or it's not.
But
personal,
I assume, but since you're so open yourself, you can probably feel very well with each of your students.
Yeah, I think I don't,
where they want to go, what they need.
Yeah, so I just try and gently, you know, help them along, but then also show them other things, and sometimes they pick up on that and sometimes not at all, and it's, you know, they can take or leave what they like. But if someone has only written for strings, then I get them to write for something else.
You know, certainly,
or try extended techniques or something. And it was a lovely moment not long ago where it's a young composer who has written for piano, but she had no idea about extended techniques. I think she had never looked into the piano. And so I showed her some things, and I could just see her eyes widening. And then the notepad came out and the thing, and you know, like, show me more, show me more, show me more. And it was so lovely. I thought, oh, it's so nice. I've opened the door. Yay.
Yeah.
And that's, it's just really nice. Sometimes you see it happening. You see the excitement of discovering something. Probably how I was all the time at Goldsmith. The first year, where my eyes just popped out everywhere. And
it's really nice to feel your excitement, and I can really visualize it, how you excite your students. Also, I mean, we also heard now, I mean, you're composing, obviously, you're sometimes part of the performance, you're teaching a lot, you have family. How do you handle all of that? Do you have any kind of time management advice for us? What can we do?
Yeah, I don't know. Every Christmas, I wish for more time. More time.
Does it work?
No. It's not so easy. Now in the lockdown, as you know, we've had some special years now as well. My work didn't go away. I had an enormous amount to write, and it didn't get cancelled. I mean, some premieres got pushed forward and pushed away, but I still had to write these pieces. And so it was very different composing, or like finding any quiet space at home with the whole family also being at home, because my children are they're now 6 and 10. They were probably 4 and 8 at the beginning of lockdown. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was a lot of mummy, 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 mummy. Mm-hmm. And thankfully I have a partner who helps a lot, and we really share. And so we did some sort of shifts, almost, that one of us would be with the kids and the other person, because he's also a musician, he also needs a headspace or quiet space, and one of us would then have a few hours at least with the door closed, you know, where you could concentrate a bit. But it was not easy, and it's very intense. It's not like you can just, you know, have a coffee and get into it slowly, and then when you feel inspired, you compose a bit. That's all long gone. It's now, oh, I have 15 minutes. Okay, I write this now. It's very practical.
Wow. But now you can be very much on the point, obviously.
Quite. Yeah. I think I have no choice, actually. There's... Okay. Obviously there's sometimes you're more inspired than other times, but often composing is anyway a way of just working with it, and once you start, ideas come and you work through it. So it's lovely if you have a stretch of time in front of you, because then you don't get just taken out of it again just when you're really in it. That is always difficult, but equally I've just learned to, you know, there is no other way. If everything is normal and the kids are at school, then I have the school hours. I used to compose in the, you know, work a lot in the evening, but I'm way too tired now. So what I do sometimes, if I don't get enough done, is to get up really early, but it has to be so early that when my alarm goes, the others don't even think about getting up. So I'm talking about 5:15, that sort of time. Because otherwise everyone is up early for no reason and I still don't get anything done. That's really horrible. Then it went wrong, the whole plan. But now last summer I had a lot to write and I didn't get enough done. And it was this long summer holidays, you know, you don't know how to do it really. Mm-hmm. And so we were in Belgium. It was supposed to be the holiday. But I always got up at 5:30 and then I had at least until 9 o'clock, because then they would wake up slowly and they're fine with my husband with getting breakfast, so they can leave me in peace still for a little while. And then suddenly it's like, if I then still continue working, then I ruined the holiday because I'm working. But until 9 o'clock, it's fine. They hardly notice. So I got a lot done and I felt so much calmer. In fact, by the end of it, I was a bit tired because I just didn't sleep very much. But that is just the kind of consequence I have to live with, I think. But it takes a lot of determination of it.
It sounds like
you want to do it, you know. Otherwise, there's no one else doing it for you. There's no one who can write the notes for you. So
nobody can do that. It's your creative brain. Well, thanks for sharing. What are you thankful for today?
Family and friends, I think, and that they are all well. It's just such a weird time that I think health is always on everyone's mind first now. Otherwise, I'm just really thankful for being able to actually live with this music all the time. Mm-hmm. It's so lovely. I mean, imagine I had not quit this economics degree. And then it would have happened like my mom said, and then you can have a piano in your office when you grow up and play in your lunchtime. Oh my God, no.
No, you're a full-time professional composer.
It would be sad somehow. I think I would not feel very... how do you say, épanoui in French? Like a flower that has bloomed.
Okay.
I would not feel fulfilled like that, I think. So this is wonderful that I can just think creatively. And also I meet so many wonderful people because I collaborate very often anyway with performers I write for. Mm-hmm. And I love it when it goes back and forth and it's really kind of written for a specific person. Even if afterwards other people also perform it, the first performance is for someone specific. Mm. And then it's lovely to have that exchange and this kind of communal creativity that is lovely. And then it also gets me to places. I traveled a lot. Where I would have never gone to if I didn't have a concert or a piece or a performer. Or it's just, I really enjoy all of that very much. And then when there are these big projects like the Neige Opera I did in Luxembourg, because I also direct my own things because I think it goes together because while I compose, I write it in a way how I imagine the scene to go, and so I don't want to relinquish that.
No, I totally understand. Some composers who have this whole picture, and for them also everything is included. I also have a composer I worked with, and I was part of the scene, and I had a plastic bag material, like a dress out of it. And then I had a coat on top, and later on I would take off the coat and you would see this other dress. But I had to move with this and nobody cared. But this composer was like, well, when you're moving, I hear the ch-ch-ch-ch of the plastic bag dress. And she's like, this is like music for me. I cannot just ignore it. And so then she had me walk always in a certain rhythm because for her it was so musical. We knew this dress was on it. It belonged to the whole play. But she then had to include it because she always also thinks everything together. And if there is a noise by coincidence, she's fine with it, but then she includes it because she cannot just say, no, you cannot just walk and make noise with this dress.
Yeah, I think that's lovely. Great.
And I was always so fascinating that she thinks of such a thing because most other composers I know, that they don't care. But she was like, no.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Do something with it.
It's often just about finding practical solutions as well, so that it's, it is included rather than something that disturbs, because that's better. Yeah. As a composer, you often have many hats. Depends a bit. Some also like to conduct their own things, and I usually don't do that because I'm not a conductor. With this Driva Drena Drop, I had to conduct it because it was more pointing and keeping a beat. I had to be the one who led it. Other things, I've worked with some wonderful conductors and some terrible ones. That happens too. But I like to direct more. You can't do everything because if you conduct, then you can't direct, I think, because you don't see it. It's too much. So I very much love to collaborate then with a conductor who brings out the best in my music, and I give another person the last touch, I guess, of the music. And that's fine for me because I think everything I really want is I've written on the page, and the rest is interpretation, which is fine. Every musician who plays also brings something. So they all make that together. That's you know, it's, that's fine.
And is it easy for you to be true and authentic to yourself in this music business? You're very alive, excited.
Yeah. Yes, I guess I am. It's an interesting question. Yeah, I think I always do exactly what I like. And so I care very little about what other people think. Not in an arrogant way, but just in a way where I want to make it how I like and then show it. And then great if someone else likes it. And then if no one likes it, then and I still liked it, then that's fine too. I'm still happy. If I didn't like it and the whole world loves it, I would not be happy still. Then it's not nice. So I try to just get my idea across, and then, but as I said, I often collaborate and you know, with the mediums that I don't know, light or costume, scenography, that sort of thing. And I have some wonderful people around who are, you know, you pick up your team in a way along the way. So when you do something and you get on very well with someone, then chances are you will work with them again. Mm-hmm. And so there are a handful of creative theater people who I keep working with, and I think then also it's about that, you know, finding something that everyone is also happy with, even if it's my opera, maybe I have like the last say of, you know, if I really don't like that costume, I can say that, and then hopefully they can change it maybe a little bit. But otherwise, I also trust that the other people bring their vision to it, and we meet. And then it also becomes authentic like that. But it's not all from me.
I must say, I really enjoyed talking with you, but we have been,
we have to finish at some
while, and maybe we should continue day.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so exciting. And I now arrived at our last question, and I would like to know from you, which tip would you like to give young artists?
Just run your own race, basically. Just don't really care about what the others are doing. I was lucky, I think, in the way that because I started at Goldsmith and it was such an open place, there were so many different composers, but there was never a competition really between us. I think everyone was just enjoying everyone else's ideas and probably had a lot of influence. There's a lot of cross-pollination like that, especially when you're studying, because you go to see the same concerts and you play each other's pieces and all of that. So ideas travel and open minds, but in the end, there was no competition. That was great. There was never a sense of we have to be successful or be a certain kind of composer. The more unique you were, maybe, and different from the others, the better it was, possibly. But other than that, so just do your own thing, because then you will find your way and you will not end up writing someone else's music. I've never really entered into all these competitions for comp- poses where you then can submit pieces, and if you get chosen, they perform it. Or I never really took part in that, but I was very lucky that the very beginning. Well, I did this PhD with this huge performance of the Mime Opera, and that I organized, I produced it, I directed it, composed, I did everything for it. And it had 39 musicians and 8 mimes and a set that we found around. There was very little budget. It was wonderful. And because I was a student, it was all the other students that I knew were in it, basically. but that set me up in a certain way that after that piece, I think I had established myself as a composer just in kind of saying, giving the picture to the world is like, I want to do this. Do ask me for, if you want the piece, ask me. And so Roger Davies then asked for a piece, which was lovely, The Harpist. And so that was my first commission. So I wrote that for him and he took it to Huddersfield, and then Huddersfield discovered me. And the next year I had a commission from them for an harp ensemble where Rodri was in as well. And so that kind of set the ball rolling, and you kind of need a couple of people like that who you can work with and who give you your first show, if you like. Yeah. because you can do some things yourself, but you can't usually perform your own music unless you only write for your own instrument and you write for yourself or something. But if you write other stuff, then you need to find the few people wherever you are who are interested in your music, who want to perform your music and who are excited about it. And maybe they are not the best performers. It doesn't even matter. They want to do it. So then you go with that. And so, so that would be the other advice. Find your people, because then you get going.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank you so much for all your sharings and great advice in it. And it was lots of fun talking to you. So I wish you all the best for all your upcoming projects, and I hope to meet you sometime, and thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
This was the interview from today. I hope that it inspired you, and please send me your emails, send me your feedback, because I love to interact with you. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I really, really hope that you liked it. And please tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. I thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene. Thank you.